Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader, brought to you by Wellington Square Bookshop. Our guest today is Rafael Yuste, author of Lectures in Neuroscience. It's published by Columbia University Press. It was released in May. Rafael is the professor of biological sciences and the director of the Neurotechnology Center at Columbia University. He's an expert on the function of the cerebral cortex, my favorite and his. He also advocates for human rights protection of brain activity, which is certainly a dynamic area right now. He's the chair of the Neuro Rights Foundation, and he helped initiate the U.S. Brain Initiative and the International Brain Initiative. So, basically, neuroscience is the study of our nervous system, its structure and how it functions, how it developed. It covers the whole nervous system, but again, it's a primary focus on the brain. And Dr. Yuste, in this series of lectures, which is now available to all of us, is basically we're taking an undergraduate course, a semester, and he's taught that same course since 1996.
So that's right.
The thing about the book, Rafael, is that not only is it accessible, which I was a little scared about, but it's fascinating. It provides us a foundation for our own neural explorations. And plus, and as a bookseller, this is very important to me, it gives us lots of questions that remain after we close the covers of the book. And those are the questions that create pleasure for us when we continue to seek the answers thereafter. So welcome, Rafael. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Sam. Thanks for your kind words. Yes, it's like taking my course, except you won't get take the exam or grade it. So you can enjoy the good parts of it without suffering through the struggle of cramming for the final. Yeah, but yeah. This is it sort of reflects 27 years of teaching at Columbia, and it got to the point where I was using these textbooks, which are classic and they're very formulaic and traditional. They're telling the whole story. Like, wait a minute. Neuroscience has moved beyond that. So there's a lot more excitement. We're living in a very exciting time for neuroscience. And how come there's not a single textbook that takes this new look at the subject? And that's why I said, well, let me, you can either wait for things to happen or you can make things happen. So I just jumped in and wrote it.
Yeah, I realized that I would like it. Like I said, I was a little nervous about, can I understand this? But when you said the cerebral cortex is where it's at, okay, yeah. I can live with it. But it's funny.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, that it's really a genuine book. I'm completely honest. And this is the spirit of my lecture. No, I don't lecture to pretending that something that I'm not and pretending that we know more than we do. And I just try to lay out in direct language. I think also neuroscience and science in general should be accessible to the public. If you cannot explain what you're doing as a scientist with simple words, then you're not a good scientist. No? There's something wrong there. No, because at the end of the day, it's not that complicated. I think the things we're trying to investigate, I mean, we dress them up in all kinds of jargon and methods, et cetera, and numbers. But at the end of the day, it's very straightforward question that anyone could understand.
Well, it's funny too, because as a bookseller, the covers of books are incredibly important. And basically when people walk in, that's what they're looking at. And the cover of this book is one of the fantastic drawings, illustrations done by Santiago Ramon y Cajal. And I interviewed this guy, Ben Ehrlich, who wrote a book called The Brain in Search of Itself. And the book was completely about Santiago. Yeah. And a similar cover. And we also have a couple of other books. And those covers are really, the guy was a genius, right?
That's right. I mean, that the book is very personal too. And I'm actually Spanish. I come from Madrid. Cajal was my hero growing up. No? Cajal is the most important scientist in the history of Spain. So, and I was drawn to Cajal and his work and his life quest to understand the brain, just like a moth to the fire, and since an early age. So this book reflects my love and admiration for the work of Cajal and for the aesthetic beauty of his drawings. And I wanted to share them with the public. I said, not only is the cover a drawing by Cajal, every chapter opens with a beautiful drawing by Cajal on the topic of the chapter, no? So or the lecture. So and just to admire those drawings, I think it's worth. I mean, I shouldn't be saying this because I have a conflict of interest, but just worth getting the book because you have essentially like a beautiful set of drawings by a wonderful scientist.
Well, this young man, Ben, who wrote the book, The Brain in Search of Itself, that title really got to me, I forgot that I had actually interviewed him. But then when you started the book talking about the brain essentially being a kind of predicting machine, almost like a time machine, and then want to discuss the model of reality that we shape for ourselves, inspired by Kant and even Descartes and Plato. So I started thinking about the concept of prediction and how are we predicting now? Is it my brain already thinking of what your next answer to my question would be?
Yes.
Go ahead, tell me about it.
I bet you, I mean, first of all, we are still quite ignorant about what goes on in your head or in anyone's head. No, but I bet you that a lot of what's going on in your head right now is not just thinking about the next answer that I'm going to be giving you, but as very evolved mammals and primates, we are thinking about all kinds of time frames from now on. What are we going to have for dinner tonight? Whether I'm going to get the paycheck or not, what's happening to my favorite soccer team? What is the future of the planet going to be when I'm not around? So we run this predictive model of the world all the way forward, and we try to extrapolate from our past as well. So they say the past is the best predictor of the future. So this, for a good model, and actually mathematics that tells you this, if you want to predict the future, you have to calculate the probabilities of things have happened in the past. Now, this is the famous Bayes theorem. So this is probably what's going on in our heads. We're calculating the future based on what we have experienced. And why do we do that? Well, because we want to see what's happening before the next guy sees it, and so that we can be in the competitive scheme of evolution, survival of the fittest. We want to be the fittest by being the smartest.
But then what happens to a person who creates his reality or her reality in this fashion? The packet of 100, you suppose there are hundreds of billions of neurons, but he's someone who believes that the earth is flat or that we never landed on the moon.
So that model of the world doesn't quite fit with the world. And this is not the first time that this has happened in evolution. You have to realize there's 750 million years of history before us of evolution of the nervous system. And at the beginning, I bet you the models of the world that small animals had were not very good. And before they knew it, they got it. So except this model has been sculpted by these 750 million years of evolution, generation after generation, species after species. And when we reach primates, and we have probably humans, Homo sapiens probably has the most sophisticated model of the world. No wonder we're sort of dominating the earth. No? The model is so good that we confuse that with reality. I think that's probably what's happening, no? that we think we live in a real world because our model is really accurate. But there's some times where it's not accurate. When does that happen? Well, actually, the book is peppered with these instances where there's a problem between the model and the world. One of my favorites is the famous blind spot in our retinas, which most readers have never heard of, or most viewers have never heard of. And it turns out that in each of our retinas, we have a spot where the nerves go in and out, the cables go, and that spot doesn't have any photoreceptors, which means that it's blind. So if you put an object in front of that spot in your retina, you cannot see it. But we have one blind spot on each retina, and they're not aligned, which means that we normally don't notice that we have a blind spot. Otherwise, it would be a disaster if the car shows up in the blind spot of your retina and you crash against it. No? But there are clever experiments that neuroscientists have devised to reveal this blind spot and to reveal these illusions that we're making up of the world. every person has also experiences this every day when they're asleep in the dreams. No? What the hell is a dream? So it's sort of that prediction machine running without being tied to the reality through the senses. No? So well, that's probably what it, yeah.
Talking about David Chalmers and Reality Plus, what it's always gotten to me, and it's bifurcated into two things, is your life has been devoted to examining an exquisite instrument using the very instrument that you're examining. And when you talk about an inaccurate model of the world and manufacturing reality, I could simply say to you, what if this is a solipsistic universe? Who would you rather be talking to, me or you?
Yeah. Well, I think that argument that some people made that we cannot understand the nervous system using the nervous system, I never got it. Honestly, I never got it. It's very likely that the cerebral cortex, just to get into a little bit more detail, which is the part of the nervous system that is completely dominating our brain in size and in function, it's very likely this is some sort of biological Turing machine. In other words, some sort of biological computer that can compute anything that has a solution. So, and that means that we can apply it to whatever we want. No? So it's like an all-purpose 4x4. No? And I don't see any problem using that machine to decipher how that machine works. I mean, I don't see an impossibility. No, I think it's an argument that it's sort of catchy and makes you, some people sound very clever, but at the end of the day, hey, I mean, we're talking about science. This is just another part of the body. The body has, we figure out how the body works step by step in the last 200-300 years of science and medicine. Why are we going to figure out how the brain works? It's just another organ.
Well, but if you go back to Descartes, you're inaccurate because the brain is not a part of the body. There's a dualism.
that part I wouldn't buy. I think, I mean, as a scientist, we're hard-nosed. We're the non-believers. Unless you show it to me and we demonstrate with numbers, I don't believe a word. No? So I read the card, it's very stimulating, inspiring, but I don't believe a word. You have to prove it to me. What the hell is he talking about? Can you measure the self? What is the self? I mean, I have a lot of trouble with sort of large philosophical concepts. I love Wittgenstein, you know, the Tractatus. Wherever you cannot talk about, you should not be speaking of. I think I take the nervous system as a challenge for science and for medicine. This is what drew me into the field. I don't see any most fascinating thing to do with my life to try to understand how the brain works. And we just take it apart with the same scientific method that has worked impeccably up to now in all kinds of biological problems, including the rest of the body. So, and we're starting to see the light at the end of the tunnel. I think there's starting to be a thread that connects with some of these old ideas, or I would say hypotheses that have been ventured by people. Rather than Descartes, I would say Kant. I think he's the one who got closer to what we're finding. You know? I mean, particularly when he talks about perception, he imagined that there were these representations of things in the world. He called them Darstellungen. And he said, what we think is out there is actually our representation of what's out there. And this is exactly what we're finding in our experiments with mice.
Okay. Then what is out there? You have to step, if you step outside, which you can't,
yeah.
If we're, yeah, representing something, am I looking out the window at these trees?
Yeah.
You're saying they may be illusory. If so, then what is out there? Or is, yeah, there anything out there?
I think the trees that you're looking at are probably existing, but your concept of a tree, even the name that you use, everything, it's all built in your brain as some sort of pointer to something out there. No? And that's why we mean by model of the world. No? So imagine that you have 1 million, our brain has 100 million neurons, more or less. 100 billion neurons. So imagine that we have a million of these concepts floating around, and one of them happens to be the tree that you're looking at the window. And through your senses, you're continuously shaping up that that model of the reality. And so it's a very good model. And if it weren't good, you would have been wiped out by evolution 500 million years ago.
That's a good point.
So I wouldn't throw it out the window. I think when we talk about reality, we have some, it's not made up. It's the brain is constructing reality using senses. And let me tell you a little bit about the senses that we have. I mean, we walk around with our eyes, our ears, our nose, and those are optimized by evolution to the physical limit. It's just unbelievable. This is nature at its best. No? The human eye can detect individual photons of light. I mean, you cannot do better than that. You cannot build an instrument that measures something that's smaller than a photon of light because that doesn't exist. That's it. Our hair cells, in the inner ear, the cochlea, can detect the movement of individual atoms. So the sounds that we perceive can be as small as a single atom moving. Like, I mean, you cannot do better than that. And some animals, not humans, but some species of moth, can smell individual molecules. In other words, they fly around and they pick up one single molecule in their nose. They can detect it. They can change their flight pattern and go towards that molecule. So you have, we're walking around, we and all the other animals, now with these senses that are just unbelievable. So that model that we have, it's really fantastic. You have to work hard to find places where it doesn't correspond to reality, because otherwise, again, most of us wouldn't be here.
Well, you know, it's funny because one of the questions you raise is, at least in my mind, when you talk about animals that are not as sophisticated as us, you talk about the possibility that they have a concept of self-awareness, and that that self-awareness, self-consciousness, might be a biological mandate.
Yeah, that's right. So again, this is a hypothesis. We're talking without really understanding how does self-awareness work? What the hell is consciousness? I mean, this is another term which it's very loosely defined. I like to measure it with numbers. But the hypothesis, and I venture into this hypothesis, I propose it in the book, is that maybe the reason that nature invents the nervous system, and this is something that happened in these little animals called cnidarians, approximately 750 million years ago at the end of the Ediacaran. Existing cnidarians are like jellyfishes, coral, sea anemone, hydrozoans, and they have the simplest nervous systems in evolution. They have very few hundred neurons spread out through the body. So it turns out that it is possible that these animals invent the nervous system because they can build the concept of self or a proto-self. And the reason I'm saying that is because we're actually studying cnidarians in the lab, and we've discovered that their nervous system has an ongoing spontaneous activity. What does it mean? That they have an ongoing activity. Even if the animal is sitting there doing nothing, then if you measure the activity of a nervous system, it's like pulsating, like boom, boom. It's not all the neurons. Some neurons are doing that job. And we have no idea what the hell are they doing. Why are these neurons active if the animal is not doing anything? Shouldn't the animal be, all the neurons be off? Well, guess what? They're not. And this regular low frequency oscillation that we've discovered in Hydra is found in all animals, all the way to humans. In fact, in humans, we have that low frequency oscillation that it's known in fMRI experiments as the default network activity. Just sort of a jargony name, but some people call it the dark matter of the brain. It's essentially the activity of the brain when you're idling, when you're not doing anything, or when you're thinking about yourself. And guess what? We have that same low frequency oscillations in humans, and you can see it in all animals down to Hydra. So I turned this discovery around, said, wait, what if that's the reason that the evolution invents the nervous system, not just to make a model of the world, but to do something much more fundamental, to make a model of yourself. Because if you don't know who you are, what do you want to make a model of the world for? You have to know where you fit in the world. So the first step is, let's make a model of me. And we do it with this regular spontaneous activity. And then once I have that anchor, I start making a model in Hydra. They probably imagine that they have only five of six representation: food, sex, light, water, whatever. No, whatever the basics.
Well, the interesting thing is, you know, you mentioned, like, you made an analogy to dark matter or dark energy. We talk about a model of the universe. One of the things that was striking when you're talking about 750 million years ago, which you've mentioned twice now because it's important, you talk about the idea that you really didn't need to have a bunch of neurons until you got big enough that you decided to move around. And yeah. So moving around, and neurons reminded me of the space-time continuum, that if you don't move yeah. around, there's no yep. space.
That's right. And in fact, I think you're onto something, because if you don't move around, there's no time. In other words, when you move around, you move in time. You move in space and you move in time. And you're thrown into another game from just being a sessile organism, like a plant, which is sitting there. Well, there's nothing I can do, so I may as well just, oh, who cares? But if you can move, you can change your future. And that's probably where everything starts to make sense. That in this book, I try to assemble the puzzle and say, wait a minute, the nervous system appears. Maybe it's related to the concept of self. The nervous system serves to predict the future. Guess what? The only animals that have nervous system are the ones that move. Why? Because if you move, you have to predict the future, because you're changing in space and you're changing in time. And your actions changes your future. So there you're thrown into another game. You have to live not just in the present, but you have to live in the future. And in order to live in the future, you have to live in the past, because you have to predict the future from the past. And that's when the nervous system, yeah.
I was going to say that, you know, we can't cover everything, but I was really fascinated not only with dreams you talked about and sleep, and again, the low frequency rhythms when we couple and decouple, as you call it. But the other thing was the interesting chapter on pain, because once again, I thought of the colloquialism, the burnt child shuns the fire. And so I was wondering, and you kind of touch on it, whether pain is another biological evolutionary imperative.
Yeah, actually, pain is fascinating, because it's, again, another place where the neurobiologist can look under the rug and nature say, wait a minute, what is in here doesn't correspond to reality. There's a disconnect. And in pain, you can see it all the time. The very famous case is the phantom pain syndrome, where amputees have pains and very strong pain in limbs that they no longer have. Like, what the hell is that? And another case, I'm actually a former patient of chronic pain, neuropathic pain. You can have pain in your limbs as if they were putting them in boiling water, okay, all the time, while you're just sitting there in a chair. Like, well, what the hell? My model of the world doesn't correspond to the reality. No one is putting my limbs in boiling water. But this is exactly how I perceive. So pain is critical because it's one of the times where you can actually, you catch nature at this game of making things up. Like, wait, nature is making things up. It doesn't exist out there. But pain is also fascinating, as you were mentioning, because why the hell would we have pain? Why would nature evolve something as brutal and as damaging as pain to hurt us on purpose? I mean, that cannot be good. Well, it turns out pain is good. And you can see it in the few cases where there's genetic mutations and there are people or animals that don't have pain receptors in their skin. And guess what? They have all kinds of lesions, because they have chronic ailments that have to do with the posture that they, I mean, we're constantly moving our posture. Why? Because we have pain sensors that, oh, my body's hurting. Let me just squeeze over, scoot to the left or to the right. So if you don't have that barrier that alerts you and your body that something it's not good out there, you're not going to change your behavior. And you're going to, again, die and be wiped out by evolution. So pain has evolved as a protective mechanism. It's hard to believe, but it is a very strong protective mechanism, because with pain, you also learning happens in one shot. This is the famous one-shot learning with pain. You put your finger in a socket and you only need to do once in your life and you will never forget. Meanwhile, if they want to teach you a phone number, good luck.
Well, the other thing I really like, since we're talking about the pain, which you do have very strong, well, also I should say the diagrams in the book are excellent. And, but you get into certain areas where you're honest enough to admit, as you do with the brief chapter on dreams, you go, who knows what the hell they are? And you just say that. And it's like, I was thinking, I can't believe you just said that.
Well, I like pointing out that the emperor has no clothes. And here we are at Columbia University, one of the top universities in the country, in the world, top neuroscientists, award-winning. And I just can't wait to tell people, we just don't know. We just don't know. We ignore most of the important answers. We're working our best to help, to figure out how the brain works, to help with the patients. No, I mean, this is absolutely urgent need to understand the brain, to help people that have mental and neurological disorders. But we have to be completely honest. And this is one thing about science. You have to be brutally honest. My mentor, I remember when the first experiment I did with him, it was like I was naked in front of him, because every single argument that I tried to make, he would nail me down. I had to be completely honest. There was no hint of any excuse or half-cooked truth. I think this is science at its best. And I think I'd like to transfer that to the public so that they know that, I mean, we're scientists, are human. We don't know everything. And even with all our degrees and our jargon, I mean, we have no idea what the hell is a dream and why we're dreaming.
Which goes back to the precursor of that, which is when you talk about sleep. And I thought, as I mentioned earlier, I think it would be helpful for our listeners to understand, because it goes to the very fundamental aspect of thought and mind, is this idea of coupling and uncoupling. You can just see two trains in a car just uncoupling when you fall asleep.
Yeah, I think it's something that we do know about sleep, is that when you fall asleep, there's a change in brain rhythms. First of all, the brain is always active. I want to dispel the notion that's out there that we only use 10% of the brain. No, we use 100% of the brain all the time while we're awake and while we're asleep. So the brain's always acting, but the way in which the brain is active changes dramatically during sleep. And one of the things that happens, there's a nucleus right here behind my neck, the midbrain, that turns on and shuts down all the muscles in the body, except for whatever reason, another demonstration of our ignorance, for the muscles that control our eye movement. So our eyes are moving all over the place and we're dead asleep, and every single muscle, we're like paralyzed. So if you think about that, nature is switching off all the muscles just so that the person doesn't hurt himself or herself. Except for the eyes, that I don't know why the nature keeps the eyes moving. And then that's when we go into the REM sleep, and we have dreams, which are some narratives that have some loose relation with reality. They feel real enough when we're in a dream, no? But they're obviously disconnected, because all of our senses are essentially off or in a low mode fashion, or our skin sensors, our breathing, our vision, our audition, everything, it's not completely shut off, but it's essentially oscillating, really. So so it's fascinating to think about that. Like, well, maybe nature is turning off the senses, is turning off the body. It's letting this program, this predictive machine, on free running to do something that is critical. So maybe when the animal wakes up, then it has a better model of the world.
Yeah, and you talk about the theoretical consolidation of memory during sleep. Yeah. But again, you say it's hypothetical. But then what I was thinking was, there's so many sleep studies. And when you do your studies, you must be able to access an enormous amount of information about what's going on. Why can't you then posit a theory as to what's happening?
The problem, this is a great question, but the problem is that we cannot decode that information. And even the access to that information is still very primitive. That's why we need new methods. That's where neurotechnology comes in. And that's one thing I devoted my life to as a scientist, is actually to build better methods to record brain activity and to change brain activity. So let me just give you a few numbers. Now, again, imagine you have 100 billion neurons in your head. If you wanted to decode what goes inside your brain during sleep, well, imagine that these 100 billion neurons would be like 100 billion pixels in a computer screen. And whatever you're dreaming, it's like a movie that's playing in your computer screen. So you better watch all the pixels, because otherwise, if you can only record from a few hundred neurons, you're going to be looking at a cool little corner of that TV screen. I don't never figure the hell out of what's playing. And this is the situation that we're at. We're just after 100 years of neuroscience, that where people have used individual electrodes to record neurons one by one. It's as futile as watching the movie in a TV one pixel at a time. And in the last 20 years, through the efforts of many people, including our group, we've developed methods to look at maybe 100 to 1,000 neurons, but not that many more. So it was still in the early days. Now we're still in some animals, we can see the whole TV screen because there are not that many neurons, like in these cnidarians. In mice, we can see a little corner of the piece of the cortex, or visual cortex of a mouse, and we can figure out a lot of things about that. No, but in a human during sleep, forget it. I mean, we're still a long time away from being able to decode what's going on.
Decoding reminds me of something we talked about earlier, going backwards now, just because I just thought of it, predicted it. Translation. So like I was looking around here because I have a really good translation of Don Quixote, but you read Don Quixote the way it was written. You're reading words that he wrote. I'm reading an excellent translation. I was in college and I asked the German professor, did he think this translation of Damien by Hermann Hesse was a good translation? And he goes, why would I read a translation? And that's what you're talking about, right?
Well, yeah, in a way, this our brain is a translation of reality. I think that's one way to put it. But it's a translation, and the translator is nature, it's evolution. And I think evolution is some serious business here. I mean, this is sculpting generation by generation this outstanding biology, you know, outstanding organisms. With I was just describing how amazed I am at the front end of the nervous system, the senses. Now, we go to the lab every day, and we come back home in the evenings blown away by what we see nature doing. And it's not just me, all the biologists. I was just looking at that nature documentary. It's like one thing after the other. I was actually in Brazil just by chance last week, and I went to the east coast of Brazil, and I saw for the first time what they call the Mata Atlantica, which is the primeval forest, not of the Amazon, but of the East Coast, which is even richer in species than the Amazon, both in plant species and animal species and bird species. I was just blown away, like, oh my God, I'm just looking at 1,000 trees and every one of them is different. And it has all kinds of weird things and shapes I've never seen, like, holy moly, this is unbelievable.
One of the things I noticed most about you in this is you're smiling and you're enthusiastic, and you've been teaching this class for almost a third of a century. And before that, you were inspired by Santiago. Why do you think you retain, just the story you just told, why do you think you retain such an enormous amount of enthusiasm and idealism as you pursue your career?
Well, I don't know. I hate to talk about myself. I think but I am Spanish, and people say that Spaniards are passionate, and that's something I have experienced in my life. I don't want to stereotype people, but Spaniards are passionate. We're the only people that run in front of the bulls. So we are definitely, we don't do things half-heartedly. Like, we go for them with all our might. And I was fascinating from a very early age about how the brain works. I was also fascinated by philosophy. If I hadn't become a neuroscientist, I would have been a philosophy major. And I can just see how everything fits together. And I honestly think that I'm privileged that I had the luck and I got good cards in life. You know, you don't choose where you're born, and you just get the cards that you get in life. No, and I was born in a middle class family in Madrid, where my parents encouraged me to go and study and supported me becoming a medic, and then I came ended up in a great lab in England in Cambridge, who shipped me to the US, and I had great mentors. So I've been lucky in the cards that I got in life, and that has I don't take this for granted at all. And I think I'm privileged that I can actually pursue my passion. I love working as a neuroscientist. I would work if they didn't pay me. This morning, I went to the lab at 7 in the morning. I don't have to go in the lab to the lab at 7 in the morning. I just love going to the lab. So I feel maybe another way to put it is that scientists, we're not really, we're more like artists. Not that it's not just another job. It's more like a passion, you know, that we like a painter. So the painter goes and doesn't have to have anyone clicking when he comes in and out of his studio. He goes and paints until the cows come home, you know, and he loves doing that, and he couldn't stop doing that. So I'm a little bit like that.
My father always said, if you wake up in the morning and you want to go to work, you probably have a pretty good life.
Yeah, exactly. I'm privileged, and I tell this to the students in our group. We're privileged that we get paid to do what we love. I mean, this is like, imagine getting paid to do your hobby. If you like fishing, but you get paid to go fishing.
It's like probably football. It's like soccer.
Yeah, like soccer.
Messi would be out there whether he was being paid or not. That's what he wants to do.
I mean, I personally love books. I'm seeing you with all the books behind you. So you must be also like, I mean, I can't believe you just love working.
Right.
In the bookstore, like, this is heaven for you. Now you go there like, oh my God, yeah. I can't believe I can make a living doing this.
It's like, yeah, I know, being a bookseller. And it's also like, you know, it's just by chance, just like you. I was sick. I had tonsillitis, and my aunt brought me a book. Because I was like 8 years old, and she brought me one book, and then, you know,
that opened it. Yeah. I never look back. I think, I mean, I feel I'm privileged, and I also feel responsible for paying back to society the good cards that I got in life. No? And the book is also one way to share with the larger public.
That's what I was
I've
saying
learned about the brain. No?
I mean, we're lucky to have this because, like I said, the accessibility of it, and, you know, entertainment sounds like I'm being, again, supercilious, but I'm not. It's incredibly entertaining and very accessible. The thing that I've been thinking about this entire conversation, especially since we've been talking about evolution and the mandates of it, is that, you know, now they call it the Anthropocene, and you have a ChatGPT and AI. Yeah. And a good portion of your life now is devoted to protecting our minds against intrusion.
Yeah. Well, I think the I'm speaking from a position of responsibility. You know, we are the lucky ones that for the whatever reason we were born in the right place, we had support at the right time. We get to become scientists and to push the frontiers of knowledge. Well, we have the responsibility of alerting society when the ship is going to find some sort of rocks in the path. And in the case of neurotechnology, we can see very clearly that this is going to be a transformation technology. It's going to be fantastic for humanity with these new methods to record the activity of the brain and to change brain activity. We'll finally be able to understand how the brain works, but at the same time, we'll finally be able to help all the patients that suffer brain diseases, now from Alzheimer's to schizophrenia to ALS, you name it. It's just devastating. I mean, it's a horrible, dark corner of medicine. We cannot do anything for this patient. So we finally are going to have those tools. But at the same time, you know, technology is neutral. You can use it to help the schizophrenic or to, and by decoding the thoughts about suicide or decoding the thoughts from a normal person about what she's going to buy or what political party is going to vote. So you get in some serious human rights issues. So that's why about 10 years ago, I decided to start working, not just in developing the methods, but in developing the ethical framework to integrate this neurotechnology in the future of society. You know, and that's when together with a group of passionate people, scientists like me, but also people coming from ethics, philosophers, coming from all over the world, representing all the brain initiatives from the world, we came up with the idea of new human rights that we call neural rights to protect brain activity. And I think this is, I feel very passionate about doing that too, because particularly being at Columbia, because just by chance, my lab, my office is overlooking the building where they built the first atomic reactor and the Manhattan Project started. That's why they call Manhattan Project. It started right there in that building, Pupin Hall at Columbia University. And eventually they took it to Los Alamos for all the reasons for the, mostly for spy, to protect against spy. I mean, Manhattan, you can never protect New York from spies. It's impossible. But
are you optimistic? I mean, I'm sometimes a fatalist, but are you optimistic that your initiatives will be able to institute protections, or do you think you'll just be bulldozed by this massive financial?
No, I'm optimistic, and I have good news to report. In fact, this morning I had a 1 hour phone Zoom call with one of the key people in the Human Rights Council in the UN in Geneva. These are the people that oversee the most serious human rights treaty, which is called the ICCPR, International Covenant for Civil and Political Rights. It's the one that protects freedom of thought, for example. So, and they're deeply interested in maybe enhancing the reach of that treaty to protect brain activity. And the reason I was in Brazil, guess what, is because I was called to duty by the Senate of the Republic in Brazil, because they've introduced a constitutional amendment to protect brain activity and the information that comes from it to all Brazilian citizens. So this amendment is going to be discussed in the next few months, but if it gets approved, Brazil will be one country, actually the second country in the world, the first one was Chile, where there is constitutional level protection of brain activity. And if we get that, we are, I mean, it's, I would be positive that this is it will ripple through the world, and with the UN and different countries protecting brain activity, we could avoid the problems of neurotechnology while benefiting from all the great things that it has to offer.
Well, it's interesting because of your career. It's like, especially with the movie Oppenheimer out now, you know, these guys out there, whether it's Zillard, who's in your book, I think, all these people, they love the idea, like you do, of learning and thinking about, is this possible? Actually, can we produce this fission and a controlled nuclear reaction? Not even thinking about the consequences, the potential consequences of what they're doing. And then afterwards, you know, I am become death. And so you are on both sides of it then.
Well, I think, I mean, to be fair, the reason why we have international protection against atomic energy is because of these people. You know, the same scientists who built atomic reactor in Pupin Hall at Columbia are the first ones to lobby the UN for regulation of atomic energy. It was through their lobby that the President Eisenhower, who happened to be also Colombia's president, he made a famous speech in the UN to the UN General Assembly in 1953, I think it was, Atoms for Peace. And he said, guys, unless we keep atomic energy under control, there goes the world. And because of that speech, the UN created the Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna, which has regulated atomic energy till today, fingers crossed, without any mistakes. So, but it was the same scientists, precisely because they knew, I mean, if you watch the movie Oppenheimer, they knew the power of this technology. I love when they said, what is the probably that the whole world will go a place? Oh, it's only 1%. Like,
that was Edward Teller that thought that was going to happen.
So I think we have the responsibility of alerting not just the UN, alerting. We're working with different governments. We went to the White House. We work with different states. We of course are talking to companies all the time, and alerting society. And we even made a documentary with a film director, Werner Herzog. It's called theater of thought. Actually, the title of the documentary goes to the heart of the matter. The brain is the theater of thought. And that documentary still has not been released publicly. It's been viewed in got awards in a couple of festivals. No? But that documentary explains the neurotechnology, the past, present, and future, and how important it's going to be for human rights issues and how we should regulate them too. No?
Well, you know, that's a great way to finish, because the theater of thought is essentially, and you even say that, you know, I thought, okay, the very beginning, you even say this is a good portion of the foundation of this book, is the reality we create. So
the name Theater of Thought credit goes to Werner Herzog, who's brilliant, and he is capturing this sentence, my whole book and everything that we're talking about.
Raphael, thank you so much. This was a pleasure talking to you. As I said, the book is, you know, if you see a book that says Lectures in Neuroscience with that cover, you may think, oh, I'm not sure I'm smart enough to read this. But what I was saying is you make it very accessible. I wouldn't say easy, but it's thought provoking, which is kind of like tautological. But yeah, it's a great book. It's on our front table, and hopefully it'll be in our nonfiction science book club. So I really appreciate you being here today.
Thank you. I really appreciate your conversation. It's been a lot of fun. Yeah.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.